This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Bram Presser. He's an Australian novelist, author of The Book of Dirt. How are you, Bram?
I'm great. Thank you.
You're visiting.
Great to be here.
You're on the road.
I'm on the road. I'm severely jet-lagged, but other than that, no, I'm fantastic.
Well, I'm really glad to have you here. This is an amazingly painful book in a lot of ways, you know, for some people like myself, like you, with family members who were not able to live through the Holocaust. You know, I wanted to ask you about what it was that got you to write this. I mean, there's some things about the book that we probably should preface to say that you call it a novel,
yep,
even though it's hard to tell the difference between autobiography, yeah, memoir, and novel. But I respect the notionality of calling it a novel because that gives you the freedom to imagine and to enter the lives.
And also where there aren't records, or where I don't have hard evidence, I think where I have to fill the gaps, it would be disingenuous of me to claim otherwise.
Right. And also I thought as I was reading this, that by making it a novel, it enables you to imagine and not just recount.
Yes. And I was really interested in what their experiences were, living it. Right. And I think you don't get that from records. You don't get that from, you know, seeing a, you know, a train schedule or a worksheet or something like that. Right. I also, at the beginning, I really didn't have anything to go by. So though I had an idea of what their stories were, I found that I had to turn to fiction to actually get to know them. I just felt that there was more, a different truth, a deeper truth in fiction than there necessarily would have been in it being a historical work, a biography or autobiography.
Well, I've read many, many memoirs of people who did live through World War II as survivors. And I think that it's different for them, because their imaginations are no longer capable of functioning by the horror and the sheer destructiveness.
Absolutely, and I also think that the purpose in writing it is different as well. I've also read so many. I've lost count of how many I've read, and I think they're offering testimony. They're bearing witness,
right,
which is an incredibly important thing to do. And so kind of imagination doesn't necessarily play into it. Like that they are the ones who lived this horror that we can't, imagine. And I think they need it documented for their own sake and for the sake of, kind of humanity as a
right,
kind of, wider.
Well, and also your perspective is different. You're living today, you're the descendant, and you're trying to place yourself in their history to create your own.
Yes.
And that is a different thing than to tell a story of what happened to you.
Yeah, look, at the end of the day, I'm making sense of my own existence,
right,
basically. Like I'm the beneficiary of their horrific experience and survival, and all the stuff that's coming out now about, inherited trauma and what have you. That is part of my inheritance, and to understand that, I have to go into their lives and try to make sense of them to make sense of myself.
Yeah, that is true. That they've talked about trauma actually affecting the genetic makeup and being passed on through generations,
yes,
which actually does make sense in our experience of people who have been through trauma.
Absolutely. And for me, it's strange because in Melbourne, where I come from, it's a very Holocaust survivor. I think Melbourne had the highest per capita Holocaust survivor intake after Israel.
Why? Right? Now, why was that?
And Well, you ask most of the survivors and they say it was the furthest place they could possibly think of from Europe.
Right.
And they're right. I mean, right. You know, like Australia is you know, out in the middle of nowhere. Like I always joke to my European friends, I'm like, to get on a plane and actually go anywhere outside of Australia is a minimum of like 5 hours. And they just laugh. They go, we can go across all of Europe for that.
Or that gets you to New Zealand.
And that doesn't even get me very far. Exactly. At best, I'll get to Bali or something like
right,
that, right?
Right.
So
what part, I mean, I don't want to kind of parse through the book to try to figure out like what is true and what isn't. This question is not about that, but it is kind of to build the groundwork for how you got there. Jakob, is it Ron?
Rand. Yeah.
Or Rand?
Rand.
Rand.
Rand. It would have been Rand in his pronunciation.
And, you know, you sort of, he's a real person.
Yes. He was my grandfather.
Yeah,
yes.
Your grandfather. And I love the beginning where you kind of go through the European, the location where they were. You know, first it was Slovenia, Ruthenia, Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, it was everywhere.
And which is true of, you know, I know my own grandparents whose parents came here talked about where they were from, and I always took it as received wisdom that they were from Hungary. But when I looked at the place where they actually were from, it's not Hungary. It just happened to be part of the Hungarian Empire at that time.
And it's funny. I actually wanted to visit the place, right? And it's in the foothills of the Carpathian Mountains somewhere, right? And I spoke to this is years and years ago. I spoke to my grandfather's brother, and he said, you know, you maybe could have a while, but now it's like abandoned, and it's like, you know, it's surrounded with brigands and thieves and people who will, you know, attack you on the road sort of thing. And he goes, you just can't go there. He said, if you can even find it.
Right? So weird.
Which is, I know. Weird. And what's the weirdest for me is that at the time that my grandfather was born and, you know, during his childhood, it was a reasonably vibrant small village, but, you know, but it was there and it was perfectly accessible from the nearby cities and whatever, and now it's at best a field.
Right. Although, as you kind of write, he wanted to leave the small town.
Yeah. Oh, very much.
Pretty
so.
Pretty desperately.
It's quite funny because he was born into a religious family. He was the son of the rabbi of that village, and he he was sort of the golden boy who was going to be the next rabbi. And by the time he was a teenager, he was not at all interested in it. He wanted to see what the wider world had to offer, and he escaped the village and he fled, and he fled to Prague in search of a secular education because that's what he wanted. And it's interesting because he clearly came with some sort of in the book. It's not so clear how his parents were, you know, reacted to it. I mean, his mother and siblings ended up coming and joining him in Prague after his father died. But he was, he was very much, I think he probably came with letters of recommendation or something like that because he was adopted very quickly into the Prague religious community. So I don't think he was as unknown as, you know, I necessarily make out in the book, but at the same time, I've got no evidence one way or the other. So it could have been that he was just someone that turned up. They liked the fact that he was quite learned and interested in learning. And he kind of had a foot in each camp. He on one side, he was part of the religious community, but on the other side, he was pursuing secular education at the, at Charles University.
Right. And what happens to him is, and again, we don't need to go through the whole story here, but it's sort of amazing some of the things that happen to him, whether that's true, you know, even as you imagine it, just the act of being a survivor in itself is pretty amazing.
Yeah. Well, actually, interestingly, because the question I get asked most is how much, you know, it's, as you asked earlier, how much is fact, how much is fiction? And most of it is a dramatization of anecdotes that I heard that are, to the best of my knowledge, true.
Or at least as told,
yes.
As remembered.
Yes, exactly.
True.
Well, exactly.
Because we don't know, as you kind of...
But it's not stuff that I made up out of the blue.
It's, no, there's a lot of it. It feels like the structure of the story is all based in, you know, at least acknowledgeable fact. But yes. As you run across, even in the story, as you're kind of trying to track back and figure out what really happened, and you're going to look at the records that do exist, you get these kind of mixed reactions. Like, that couldn't have happened. Yeah. That's not real.
I actually still remember, like, walking into... So the two... I mean, obviously, everyone knows Yad Vashem. It's the, you know, the main Holocaust museum in Israel. So other camps have, like, smaller museums kind of scattered around the place. And my grandparents were in Terezinstadt. There's a place called Beit Terezin in Kibbutz Givat Chaim, which is somewhere in the north. East of Israel. And I remember going there and I had this story in my hand. After he died, this article was published saying that he had been the curator of, the literary curator of Hitler's Museum of the Extinct Race.
That's the story he told.
So that's, that's the story that was told about him.
Right. But it must have come from somewhere.
Well, this is the thing. The one question that still, like, haunts me after writing the book, well after it's been published and what have you, is to what extent was he complicit in telling that story?
Right.
And anyway, so it's pretty clear that story isn't true, but there is something that is similar, that is true, that I've come to believe he, having heard this story of the Museum of the Extinct Race and not really knowing why he was doing what he actually was doing, kind of linked it in his head,
right.
And it would have made sense to him. It would have actually made perfect sense to him at that point when he heard about this museum, that's what he was working on.
Right, because we explain stuff to ourselves in order to be able to understand
have gone through anything in the Holocaust, which I think must have been, in many ways, I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, the most kind of meaningless experience. Was literally horror for horror's sake. Right. And so when you're searching for meaning in that, you'll end up, you know, attaching to something that in any way makes sense to you. And so I think he, you know, without spoiling too much, you know, he was in this Talmud Commando, which was a group of 30 odd scholars who were tasked with sorting through books that had been stolen from from congregations around the Reich that had basically been destroyed, and sorting through and cataloging these books. And he didn't necessarily know why he was doing it. So this Museum of the Extinct Race would have seemed perfectly reasonable to him as the explanation.
Well, and also in the situation of it was enabling him to live by having that job, because he was not sent to a gas chamber.
Well, and I think there was a massive guilt complex from him. Like, when he was taken to Auschwitz, he was actually still reasonably healthy, right? So he spent 6 odd weeks in Auschwitz, in Birkenau, in the Czech family camp. And people died en masse there from starvation. They weren't being gassed and shot and whatever in that particular sub-camp.
So slave labor.
But they were still worked to death, and they were still starved, and there was, you know, horrific disease and whatever. And but he had an advantage going in there, thanks to this Talmud commando that he'd been in Theresienstadt, because he had better rations, he had decent accommodation for, you know, sleeping arrangements, things that his friends and his family didn't have. His brother went to the Czech family camp, and in its first, they liquidated that camp every 6 months, right? And his brother was in the first intake, and his brother was gassed after the first 6 months was up. Was there during the final liquidation. And in the final liquidation, they picked the people who were still healthy to move on to work camps. And he was still, I mean, look, it was 6 weeks, and he was obviously a lot worse for wear than when he arrived. But had he arrived in a state where he was actually, you know, emaciated or otherwise, you know, sick or what have you, there's no way he would have survived. And he blamed himself to his dying day. And I knew this about him. And this is something that he did speak about, for the death of his mother. And he genuinely believed that having taken rations from his mother in this Czech family camp, in Birkenau, that he caused her to die. Because when they did the selections, the mother was chosen to stay behind, which meant be gassed. And he moved on. And he believed that had he not taken these rations, she would have been healthy enough. And there is no, she would have been at that time in her late 50s, early 60s. They weren't moving any late 50s, early 60s right. women into work camps. She was going to die, whatever happened. Right. But he genuinely, so like all of these things, all the way, you know, his involvement in telling his story would have been a way to explain to himself why he survived. And I don't think assuage the guilt, but at least understand the cause of the guilt, or the, you know, or kind of make some sort of peace with the guilt,
right.
And say that it was, you know, he survived through this, being part of this incredible plan that the Nazis had to make this museum, and that was just luck, because really 90% of survival was luck,
maybe more.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe more. That's right. Probably actually 99.9.
It's just so hard to imagine. I just, you know, one cannot.
No.
It's just not possible. But also to realize that humans do this to each other.
Yes.
It's not a unique happening.
No, that's the horrific thing. I mean, you sit there and I always think about the, you know, after, never again, never. And it just happens again and again. Like, yeah. You know, or different scales, different, you know, situations, context.
Cambodia, we have
Cambodia, Rwanda, exactly.
Now Yemen,
yeah, exactly.
Which no one wants to talk about.
Yeah, oh, they're just and it's you know, look at the Rohingya people. Yes. It's horrific. South Sudan, Darfur.
Yeah,
it's unbelievable what humans are capable. And it's interesting because when you really, like, kind of commit yourself to writing about this and trying to understand it, it gives you perspective on both the best that people can
right.
be
right.
and the worst. And it's in some way, like, I don't know, I like to think that you end up with some sort of equilibrium, because like sometimes you're like, wow, people are amazing, and the things they can do to survive and the things they do to help each other, and it's just extraordinary. And then you look at the other side of it and you just go, wow, people are terrible.
Right. Well, like, we can contain both of those realities. And I think, you know, it's one of the reasons why, even though I found this book painful, I have to admit, partially by identifying, and, you know, because a lot of people in my family, I have no knowledge of anybody who was there. Hmm. So it's kind of projective to be able to read your book, but it's still painful, you know, to realize that what happened to the people in your book, they're just a few people out yeah. of millions.
Well, that's the amazing, like someone says, you know, are there still Holocaust stories to tell? Yes, there are so many, because every survival story appears to be unique. Like, right. and
you know, oh, even the ones who didn't survive.
Yes, and exactly,
those are all, you know, and some of the work is about, you know, remembering and allowing them to live in memory.
Well,
or
it's very interesting you say that, because a thing that happened, which I, for me, in writing the book, one of the most kind of extraordinary experiences was while I was kind of early on in the piece, or kind of midway in the piece, when I was mainly writing it as a work of fiction, because I didn't have a lot of the documents that came to me later, I got an email from a 94-year-old guy in London, and he said to me, look, here's my class photo from 1942 in Prague. I've spent the last 30 years since my retirement trying to find out what happened to all the people in my class. The only person I couldn't find was my teacher, Jakob Rand. And I've been, every year I type his name into Google. Right. And I just love this 95-year-old guy, you know, typing in Google every year. Right? And every year I type it in Google and I try to find him. And nothing. And this year it came up. It came up with you, because, you know, people have been talking about this kind of crazy guy who's running around trying to find his grandfather's story, and just like, he's like on an obsessive quest, and you're at Beit Theresa, and yeah, I was going to say before, like when I turned up to Beit Theresa, and they kind of look at me like, you know, you're clearly not a serious researcher, and your story is the story you're coming to me with is basically rubbish, right? So I didn't, you know, I wasn't getting far. Anyway, so he said, I think this might be you and your, this, I think this might be your grandfather. I think your, Jakob Brand, this teacher, might be your grand. Now, this photo I can clearly see is my grandfather. I mean, it's like, you know, he, at 85, he didn't look greatly dissimilar to what he looked like at 25, right? Just a, you know, somewhat older version. Anyway, so I ended up going and meeting him, and I went to London. He lives in Suffolk now, and amazing, amazing guy. And he said to me, I want you to promise me one thing, that when you come to write this book, I'm going to tell you about all the kids in my class. I think probably about 90% of them were killed, right? And he said, I want you to write about them as people, make them characters, right? And then we'll, yeah, and that way, because my quest is to give these children life that was denied them.
Right.
And so I got to the point, so there's chapters in the book where that take place in the school where my grandfather was teaching, and these kids are, and they actually some of them reappear in later chapters in Terezin and also in Birkenau. And when we came to editing it, my editor was like, oh, look, you know, do we need all these kids in it? And I said, I agreed with 95% of her edits. I said, this is one thing I'm going to dig my heels in, because I made a promise to this guy that these kids are going to become people again. And that to me was really important. And similarly, my grandfather's best friend, George Glansberg, who also, interestingly, this guy in England, his name's Frank Bright, František Brichter, as he was back then. And he said to me, did your grandfather ever mention someone called George Glansberg? And I said, funny you should say that, because he mentioned him once, and for some reason the name has stuck in my head. He mentioned him during my brother's bar mitzvah, during a speech, and he just mentioned him in one line, which was, why me, why not Glansberg? And he's talking about his survival.
Right.
And I never knew who Glansberg was, but the name always stuck in my head. And I was 10 at the time of my brother's bar mitzvah, so it's strange. And he said, Glansberg is the guy standing next to your grandfather in the photo. He was the other teacher. It was his best friend.
And they worked together.
And they worked together. Yeah. They were, you know, in Prague, unquestionably, George Glansberg was my grandfather's guy, right? And they were absolute best friends. They hung out all the time together. They were both, you know, they both had, you know, doctorates, and they were both, you know, highly learned, and but they were both young guys and what have you. So to me, Frank told me a lot about Glansberg, because interestingly, just purely by chance, Glansberg, after the schools were closed in Prague to Jews, Glansberg gave private tuition to Frank for his bar mitzvah, and my grandfather gave private tuition to Frank for Hebrew. And so he actually had an in with both of these men personally, outside of just the school, because right. apparently his Frank's father was well connected to the community, and so could get kind of private tuition for Frank afterwards. So it was just amazing. And like, to me, to be like, to hear about this man who just sounded like a fantastic guy, and I can see why my grandfather would have loved him, right? And also why my grandfather felt so, I don't know, guilty about having survived without his best friend, when they actually had almost identical trajectories through the Holocaust. Right. The only difference they had was that my grandfather was not well enough to go on a death march and was left behind in one of the camps, and George died on a death march. And that was on that death march.
When they were moving
at
him,
the very end.
Moving him right? to another camp.
Yeah, like
because the Russians were coming.
Yeah, the Russians were coming. The war was over. They were just, you know, trying to basically march the Jews as far as they could, have as many of them die as they possibly could. And I don't think they even had any great plan for where they were taking them. They were just marching, right? And so, yeah, so for me to be able to give George a life as well, because to me, he seems a very important person, interestingly, in my life as well, because he was so important to my grandfather. This is someone that I can imagine, had he survived and grown old, I would have actually known.
Right.
And I would have probably, he would have been Uncle George or something to me.
Right.
And I think it's really sad that I don't, you know, that I didn't get to know him, and that my grandfather, I think, really mourned him for the rest of his life.
So have you heard from people who have read your book, you know, how it affected them? You know, have people talked to you about how it connects to their own experiences?
Yeah, look, it's interesting. I get a lot of people who talk, particularly people with Czech backgrounds, that they found the stuff about Theresienstadt and also life in occupied Prague, they found that particularly powerful for them to understand what their family had kind of experienced, because, you know, it was obviously a different experience. But also, when I talk about my grandmother's side, and the scenes in Theresienstadt on my grandmother's side are a lot more what I would call probably the more regular Theresienstadt experience. You know, my grandfather was working kind of in a hut a couple of hundred meters out of Theresienstadt, whereas my grandmother and my great-grandmother, that being my grandfather's mother, were properly, you know, in the, one in the laundry, one in the right. kitchen, what have you. So
and these are, this is the woman whose mother, if I remember this right, their mother was not Jewish.
Yes.
Father was Jewish.
Yes.
So the mother was able to stay in Prague and was able to smuggle food into them.
Well, interesting, while I was searching for my grandfather's story, this was not meant to be about my grandparents initially. This was a completely single-minded, obsessive quest to find out my grandfather's story, which came to nothing very early. And I happened to be in Prague on the way back after that trip where the lady at Beit Theresien just kind of like, you know, kind of shook her head and walked away from me. And I mean, don't get me wrong, they were lovely, but they were just like, I was presenting them with a story that was kind of demonstrably not true. And they were just like, this seems like it's a wild goose chase, really. But when on my way back, I went through Prague and my mum's cousin was there. He's a fantastic guy, and we're having coffee, and he said, look, I know you're looking for your grandfather's story, but I have something you might be interested in. And his mother, who was my grandmother's youngest sister, had just died, and he was cleaning out her house. And at the back of her closet, he found a shoebox, and in it were these letters. And he just unfolds it, like, and you've got to imagine, on the most like fragile paper, the tiniest handwriting in pencil, because these are letters that your grandmother sent from the concentration camps off to her mother back in Prague. And in it, like, there was talk about, you know, food and medical supplies, and there's a line in it that says something to the effect of, you know, we were just where they use gas. I'll tell you about it when I get home. Like, amazing stuff from within the actual Holocaust experience. Because these are, you know, some, they permitted like little postcards to come out, right? But, and they had like, I think it was like an 18-word limit or a 20-word limit. But these were full letters. So these were smuggled out, right? And they also talked about this Mr. B, who was the conduit for getting the supplies in and out. And yeah, so my grandmother and my great-grandmother were in contact through almost all of their time in my grandmother's time in the concentration camps. The only time they weren't was during her reasonably short stay in Birkenau. That there was no though there is some suggestion there was, right? Because there is a story that one of the letters was intercepted, and this happens in the book. One of the kind of the classic stories of my grandmother's survival was it was intercepted by the Nazis, and they called her out during one of the like parades, and they called a girl out to translate, and the girl was apparently a 15-year-old Polish girl. They actually just asked for a volunteer. They said, "Can someone translate this letter?" This girl comes out, and she holds the letter. And she reads it in inverted commas and literally makes up what's actually in the letter and so that it's completely innocuous. And my grandmother was like beaten to within an inch of her life, but she wasn't sent off and killed. Right. And my grandmother, I think from what I understand, spent a long time afterwards trying to find that girl and never did because she owed her life. And she didn't even know the girl either. That's the amazing part. This was a girl who just took it upon herself to essentially save my grandmother's life. And that's, so anyway, my great grandmother, as you said, wasn't Jewish. Or she was a convert, but by Nazi standards, she wasn't Jewish. So she and the two youngest daughters, so my grandmother was the oldest of four girls, stayed in Prague. And my great-grandfather, who was Jewish, and the two eldest sisters, my grandmother and my auntie Irene, went to concentration camps. And, and they stayed in touch throughout. My great-grandfather died. Was killed. My grandmother and her sister survived. And it was thanks to really the extraordinary bravery of my great-grandmother. I always say I set off to find my grandfather's story. I ended up with being in absolute awe of my great-grandmother, who I knew her. I was 13 when she died. And she was like, 4'9". As a little kid, she was in her late 80s. You know what a late 80s looks to a little kid. She was impossibly old and shriveled and what have you. And to think of her and the stories I heard about her whilst researching this and I found out through various family members and friends and what have you, she was just amazing. She visited my grandmother in the concentration camp in Theresienstadt. And I thought that was just impossible. When my cousin, my Czech cousin Ludwig, when he told me that they had visited, I was like, that's not possible. I'm ridiculous. And not only that, my editor called me on that. And she said, there's no way that happened. She goes, unless you find evidence of people actually being able to visit concentration camps, that can't be in the book. And I spent a long time and I found records of, and there's actually I would say it's a famous documented story because it's clearly not well known, but there's a story of a man who went into Theresienstadt, went as far as the commandant's office to speak to she was his cleaning lady or something, and he wanted to visit to make sure she was okay. The commandant kicked him out and said, get out of here sort of thing, right? But people actually did go. And so this story, which seemed completely impossible, or at the very least, highly implausible, turned out to be entirely possible. And based on, because Ludwig had actually spoken a lot to my great-grandmother, she was Ludwig's grandmother, and he was very close with her. And in her older days, they spent a lot of time together talking about life and the war and what have you. And she told him a lot of these things.
Where did she live?
Prague.
And so she stayed in...
She stayed in Prague. This is the amazing thing. My grandmother and Irene moved to Australia, and they remained, till their death, committed Jews. My great-grandmother and the two younger daughters, and the reason they weren't taken was because the law was, if you were under 14, if you were a half-breed, a Mischling, right, you stayed with the non-Jewish, and as soon as you turned 14, you were taken to concentration camp. If you're over 14,
right, you go.
You went. Yeah. And so that was how it kind of panned out. But so she stayed in Prague, and they, after the war, became completely, they did away with their entire Jewish identity. And so I have an entire non-Jewish family in Prague, very close with them, but they don't consider themselves at all Jewish. And then the family who came to Australia all consider themselves very strongly Jewish in terms of their kind of personal identity, whether it be religious or more a kind of just a traditional...
Right, culture.
Yeah, cultural thing, yeah.
So do you mind reading a little bit?
Sure.
I think we talked about doing that. It would be nice to for people to hear a little, because I think the writing in this book is really great.
Thank you. So this happens when my grandfather is sorting the books in Theresienstadt. He's met my grandmother. And this was actually a big part of the book because I wanted to find out how my grandparents met each other. And so he's met her because she is bunking in the dormitories with my grandfather's mother, right? And he has he doesn't want to admit he does, but he has a crush on her. She is in love with someone else. But anyway, that was actually until their marriage, that was pretty much the story of his life. Okay. She danced between the lines in the kingdom of paper. It started with the slightest glimpse, a blonde curl behind a slanting lamed, a flash of skin, perhaps a wrist, a shoulder, or even a thigh, through the crook of a bait. By some mistake of gravity, he had ascended to the heavens where only gods and angels dwelled. He looked at George, at Munellus, at Gottschall, at Seligman. But they were lost between pillars of pulp, blinded to this shimmering sprite. She grew more brazen with the days, revealing more of herself on each new page. There was nothing suggestive in her moves, just the sheer delight of freedom. She cared little for his startled gaze. At times she swirled the ink around her in a frantic pirouette until the words blurred like a shroud across her shoulders. Jakob sat back and wiped his brow. No, it was pointless. It was like leering at a sister, a child. And was he not just seeing her with his mother's eyes? He knew how Gusta looked on when they talked, imagining what might have been, what still could be. But theirs was nothing more than a convenient alliance. Her packages, his privileges, pulled to create a semblance of plenty. Outside the barracks, away from these books, she danced for others. He had seen her in the park on his way back from the bastion, huddled close to a young man under a tree. And what to make of the other times, when she would loiter near the gate at day's end, and run the moment she caught sight of Jakob coming up Sudstrasse. Jakob was certain he saw the gendarme right himself before hurrying over to unfasten the lock. Jakob looked at the SS man by the door. He rarely moved, as if asleep. Only once had he stood to attention, when Eichmann himself came to visit, to compliment these shackled scholars, to show that he, too, could speak in their tongue. "It is very important work you're doing, gentlemen," Eichmann had said. That was before September, before the council announced the resumption of transports, before they took Schmuel away. He should have known. Eichmann's presence boded ill for them all.
It's good. Well, I really want to thank you for doing this. It's been great.
Oh, thank you.
And thanks for writing this book. I think it's really good thing that you've done. So this has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Bram Presser about the Book of Dirt.